First, let me bring in the bench coach of the Giants, Ron Wotus. Well, good morning.
Good morning, Marty.
All right, we've made our technical adjustments here, Will, and they can hear you fine now.
Great, great. That's the first glitch I've ever had with you, Marty. How are you? 15 years we've been doing this.
I'm going to blame someone else. No, it probably was my fault. They got too many things to do. All right, but talking a little bit about Nick Turley.
Okay.
50th round pick, and what struck me about him, and he's been five organizations, Somerset and the Independent League and all this stuff. And all of a sudden he got to Chattanooga, which is an old Washington Senators Minnesota Twins farm team for years, the Chattanooga Lookouts. And he ends up down there this year, and he strikes out 14 in six innings. Thanks, Pat. 14, Patrick's coming in to see if we're okay here. 14 in six innings, and then they bring him up to the AAA Rochester, where our good friend Mike Quadi is a manager. And he strikes out 15 in six innings. So he was at Sacramento, and he always said, boy, he had Vogelsong and Zito and Lincecum and Kane and all those guys. Couldn't break through here, but he gets his major league debut today in San Francisco.
Yeah, you know, guys persevered. There's no doubt about it. And, you know, over the years, you see a lot of players do that. I mean, my years managing in the minor leagues, you'd have guys that never got a major league opportunity, but they kept coming back to AAA, keep coming back, putting up good numbers. And they persevere. They stay with it. They start throwing the ball really well, and they get an opportunity. So he's pitched well enough to be here. And now, you know, the pressure's on him to do it at this level, because guys like him don't always get the second and the third chance. So, you know, he'll get an opportunity today, and hopefully, we'll get to him and not let him have that great opportunity here in San Francisco.
Yeah, 27 years old. So I want to mention Nick Turley, because it's an interesting story, and formerly was at Sacramento with the Giants.
Right.
And I don't know if we saw him in spring training or not. I don't remember.
I remember
really.
The name. He may have come over a day or two in Major League Camp, but everybody recognizes the name. And I know our people in development here, you know, know more about him, but it's the Major League staff. So it'll be interesting to see him pitch today.
Yeah, left-hander. All right. Well, getting back to the professor here on this Sunday morning, good to see you, and I enjoy do these shows. We always look forward to them. We talked a lot about Wrigley Field the last time, and I want to talk a little bit about grounds rules, you know, when you go to the plate and all this stuff, because we had an incident in Milwaukee that was really fascinating for the broadcasters to describe it, for Bob Uecker to describe it. And what happened, you can describe it, of a ball that sort of got lodged somewhere, but Calixte, in his youth, went and grabbed it and made a play, and then all of a sudden the tying run scored, and then they took it off the board. What happened?
Well, you know, in the past, the rule has always been that, you know, if a ball gets lodged, or if it's in the ivy at Wrigley Field, or it gets stuck in the bunting, you know, during the playoffs, you have that around. You throw up your arms, and then the umpire would come out to verify that the ball is lodged. Now, once you throw up your arms, and you can't say, okay, here comes the umpire. Well, if you decide 10 seconds later, I'm going to pull that ball out of the ivy, it would be a live ball. The ball would still be in play. So you'd have to throw up your arms, let the umpires come out, visually see that the ball has disappeared or lodged, and they would, you know, do the ground rule from there. But now with the video replay, we had the meeting in the spring, and so that's what happened in Milwaukee. The ball was lodged in the padding and the outfield wall. There's kind of a low padding and a high, and there was a little gap in there, and it got stuck. It was visible. But even today, if the ball gets stuck underneath the fence, you know, there's the dirt and then there's the padding. If it just gets lodged there and stuck, they will consider that a lodged ball. It's replayable, and the ball is dead, and they send the runners back. They put the ground rule in effect, ground rule double in this case, just like it happened in Milwaukee, and really saved the game for us, because those runners were going to score and we're going to advance.
Yeah, did you realize it? Because it all happened so quickly, and honestly, you know, everyone thought he's got to put his hands up.
Right.
And when he didn't put his hands up and made the play, I was listening on driving home. Bob Uecker was on, so I flipped over to him just to hear what he was saying. And he was off on, you know, he didn't put his hands up, the ball's in play. And then, of course, the key is replay. Now that you can replay it, as Eddie Montague explained to me yesterday, now that you can replay it, as soon as the umpire sees it's lodged, it doesn't matter if you pull it out of there or not, it is a dead ball.
Right, and, you know, we have to be on top of this. And the difficult thing today is, you know, we've all been in a game our whole life. I mean, I've been in professional baseball since I was, you know, 18 years old. And, you know, you start coaching and you know the game, you know the rules. There are so many rule changes in the last few years of the game of baseball. It's hard to keep up with them. And you can study them and you can know them, but what happens is you get into the daily grind of what you do, anybody at work, you know, you doing this, and you're not always aware of all these changes because there's so many of them. So, you know, we need to be aware of them. We obviously need to be in tune with that. And the good news is we have, you know, Sean Dunstan and Chad Chopp in the replay booth. You have other coaches. You have people, everybody knows these rules. So somebody can speak up and say, hey, jog your memory on that. Because, you know, it is difficult with all the changes sometimes. You know, your mind's thinking, you know, 20 years ago, how you played it. And now it's totally different. So, we're aware of it. And thank goodness the umpire got it right away. So we didn't have to bring it to his attention.
Yeah, it was interesting because, the runner went back to third, and then Nunez makes this great play. Melanson gets out of trouble, and you guys bust it open, and you win a game. So that's where replay helped you.
Right, absolutely. And a big moment, to say the least, in the game. And, that was a great call by the umpire to see that. It wasn't stuck there that long. The ball was still visible. And that's one of the changes in the game with the rules this year.
So what do you tell the outfielders now? If the ball is lodged, just throw your
Throw your hands up. They can play it two different ways. In reality, if they think they can keep the guy from a double, which is very hard to do when a ball lodged in the outfield. I know Benji Molina sometimes had a difficult time. I remember seeing him hit a ball to the left field corner and not get a double on a ground ball. But most runners are going to get a double. You know, they could play it. They could play it if they think they could stop the runner from scoring, opposed to having the ground rule take effect. But that's a long shot, you know. So they don't have to worry about throwing their hands up and letting the umpire check it. We have replay now, but we certainly want them to let us know if the ball's lodged. They have the option to throw up their hands.
He had quite a week, Calixte, if I'm saying his name correctly. I hope I am. In the outfield, he made a throw earlier in the week that really just airmailed everything, hit the screen, and then went straight down behind the advertising. I'm sure in your life you've seen throws. How about that one?
Yeah, well, you know, that was a first as well, seeing the ball disappear behind. Again, a lodged ball. A lot of these, you know, when you go over the ground rules at home plate, you know, they talk about the different scenarios. You know, we got quite a few of them here in this park. We have nooks and crannies. We got the metal awning in right field, that's a home run. The big brick facing is not. You have the bullpen area down there with no definitive line. So there's some different rules here, but they always go over home plate, you know, what happens behind home plate. Now, if the ball disappears, obviously it's a dead ball, but nobody expected that ball to disappear behind the signage. Usually it's sitting right up on top, and it disappeared, and I heard the ball went down and went right into the stands. And the pitcher backing up, I can't remember who it was at the time, he was flabbergasted by it because we wanted to stop that guy from scoring, and here we go, they get another run because of that ball disappear. Never seen that. Never seen it at home plate.
I thought it was Kane. I could be wrong.
Yes,
I thought it was Kane. Plus, let's the professor's here, so let's talk about the ground rule, though, which is interesting, and I always remember this from playing softball. I think it's the same in the big leagues, but if the throw comes from the outfield, you get the base you're going to and one more.
Correct.
That's why the guy who had rounded second heading to third, they allowed him to score.
Right. Two bases. One base, if a pitcher on a pickoff throw throws it away because he's on the rubber. So if the pitcher tries to pick somebody off and he throws it away into the stands, he only gets one base. Now, if the pitcher steps off the rubber, and, you know, steps back and then throws it away, it's two bases.
Is
because
it?
He becomes a fielder now. He becomes a fielder. He disengaged the rubber. He's not pitching, throwing the ball.
Okay.
He becomes a fielder, and he'd be awarded two bases. And, you know, your friend Eddie Montague, if he's listening out there, can confirm that for us next time he's on.
So if a shortstop, let me finish up with this. So if a shortstop throws a ball away into the stands, and a guy is going to, and he's going to first base, he only gets second, though, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Because the ball's out of play, it's the one base. Yes.
I got it. All right. Boy, you got to be a professor to do this stuff. So it brings this question up. Okay, maybe some of the oddest ground rules that you ever came up with? I know maybe, you know, you've seen so many stadiums, so many new stadiums now.
Yeah.
And you're the guy who goes out there to talk about ground rules most of the time. What do they tell you?
Yeah, you know, it's hard off the top of my head here to come up with the oddest, but I'm always concerned here in San Francisco that the ball is going to hit a seagull. Right? When the seagulls are flying around, and I'm concerned that that's going to happen, but the ball's in play if it does. So that's an odd thing that it's amazing that it's never happened, because we do get a lot of seagulls here, and you get it in other ballparks once in a while as well. I'll never forget a story that Bob Kennedy told me years ago, who was our minor league director, ran the Giants for years and years, done everything in the organization for the San Francisco Giants, and a great man. But he tells a story in spring training. It was a spring training game, and it was the bottom of the ninth. The guy hits the ball, okay, and it disappeared. Nobody saw the ball leave the park. The ball went up in the air, and they just called it a home run because they didn't know where it went. I don't know if it was the clouds, the condition, but they actually didn't see it leave the park. And he was flabbergasted by it. He says that ball just basically disappeared, and nobody knew where it was. Now, he loved telling that story, and I can't imagine that happening in a major league ball game with all the cameras we have. But who knows? At dusk in a particular time with the right conditions in the spring, I guess it could happen.
Well, there was a very famous homer in 1938, the homer in the Gloman, as they call it, Gabby Hartnett for the Cubs, the manager. It was the last pitch of the game because it was getting so dark at Wrigley, there were no lights. Hit a home run, they call it the homer in the Gloman.
Yeah.
And hit it into left field. No one ever saw it. But
right.
It went into the seats in left field and actually won the pennant for the Cubs.
Really? Well, there you go. So I guess it's happened more than once.
Yeah. And also, you know, it's interesting to talk about it. The foul poles used to be much shorter. And the umpire would have to figure it out if it was a fair or foul ball. And then they, of course, lengthen the foul poles. Now they're tremendous, and that, now you can figure it out.
Sure, and you have the replay to see it, because that probably is one of the most difficult calls. And, you know, Eddie, again, could say that for an umpire. Those long home runs, you know, did it hook around the pole?
Right.
So it's really good that they have raised a lot of the foul poles up a lot higher.
And since Minnesota's here, it reminds me of Dave Kingman, who in the old Metrodome, I don't know if you ever had ground rules in the Metrodome or you remember it, but he hit one through the ceiling. You know, it was a cloth ceiling or whatever it was, and there was a hole in it, and he hit it through the ceiling, and it disappeared.
Okay, so you know, Bob's story, there's more than one disappearance. But those types of ballparks, I have been to the Metrodome, the Baggy out in right field.
That's
that
right.
Was a difficult place to play. It was loud, the crowd noise. It was a different world in a lot of these ballparks, Tampa Bay with the catwalks.
Yeah.
You know, it seems to be the dome stadiums that have some of the more unique ground rules in play.
Well, I'd say that may be the most unique, that you brought it up, and that's the catwalk in Tampa.
Yeah.
You know, what took you to the Metrodome? What brought you there?
We played here. I think it was, I don't know what year it was. First year of interleague play. The Metrodome was still, we may have went twice. Ray Durham was at the club, I remember,
that
point in time. But we went and we played Minnesota in the Metrodome.
Yeah, because Target Field's only a few years old.
Right.
That's right. Boy, yeah, the baggie. How about that?
Yeah.
Come on, hitting a ball. Ken Herbeck used to pound that baggie.
He sure did. Yeah, yeah. No, it was a unique place to play. And, you know, it's kind of nice that some of these parks are out of there. The AstroTurf is gone. You know, the playing surfaces are all the same, basically. It was very difficult as an infielder to play on grass all year and then go to AstroTurf, or tougher yet if you're an infielder and you're playing on AstroTurf at home and then you go to grass, because the game is played a little bit different. The ball bounces different. You approach it different when you field on AstroTurf. You don't have to really get your feet always in position. You can just use your good hands to catch the ball. So I think it's great that most of the AstroTurf is out of the game for many reasons.
Did you play in the Astrodome?
Did not play, but I coached there as well. My first year, 98, was in the Astrodome. And it might have been before. I'm not sure if it was 98 or I came up with the team when I was managed in San Jose.
Okay.
I came up like the AAA manager comes up in September. I actually came to the major leagues, and I think it was 91 or 92. I was a September call-up as a coach, and that's when I had a chance to be around Roger Craig and Bob Lillis, and that was really my first experience with those guys. But they had me travel with the team in September, and And I believe that's when we were at the Astrodome. It wasn't when I was actually coaching.
What do you think of the Astrodome? And I bring it up this way because they always claim that they put the air conditioning on when the Astros hit.
Right.
And they shut it off when they didn't hit to give them a little bit of extra wind.
Right. Well, you know, who's going to deny that? That's not true. I mean, I remember being there. I heard the same thing. And you get that in a lot of parks around the leagues, a lot of these indoor stadiums, you know, how they can manipulate the air conditioning. The Astrodome was obviously a great building for its time. It was very, very impressive. But there's been other parks that the people claim the same thing with the air conditioning. And you know what? If the rumor's out there, it is very, very well could be true because everybody's trying to win games any way they can.
Boy, very good. What do you think of Bob Lillis? They call him the Flea. I remember him when I grew up. He was a backup shortstop for the Dodgers, always behind Pee Wee Reese. Roger Craig, of course, pitched for the Dodgers in the mid-50s. What do you think of the Flea, Bob Lillis?
Well, I really liked him. Obviously, I took to him, and he was very forthcoming, and really talked to me a lot. In that September time, of course, I saw him in the spring, being an infield guy, and he's an infield guy. I was managing at the time; he had managed. I thought he did an outstanding job. Had a great relationship with the players. The players really liked him. One thing that really stood out: he was one of the first guys that started putting down the release times because Roger created what the slide step and all this, you know, controlling the running game. Well, Bob Lillis actually had like a little Palm Pilot in his hand, and he would plug in the release times of the pitcher way back then. So he wasn't writing it on paper; he put it in his little. I think it was a Palm Pilot or something, one of the first electronic devices that can store that information. So he was really in tune with that, and great man, great man.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up Roger Craig and his ability to change pitchers and do things. We always think of him as Hum Baby, right? You know, just sort of the big manager and all that stuff. Don't worry, Hum Baby. But I guess he's a pretty smart man.
Yeah, you know, he was a motivator, obviously, always positive, always upbeat, you know, made you feel good. You know, the running game, I believe he was the one that really started introducing the slide step and breaking down, and maybe there was someone before him, but breaking down the release times of the pitcher. You know, if the pitcher's under 1-3 and the catcher gets the ball down at 1-9, you know, the guy's not going to be able to steal. So they put some science behind that part of the game and, you know, him controlling the throwovers and the pitch outs and all those things. I don't know how much it was done before then, but I know I was told that he was one of the first that was involved with really bringing that to the forefront and kind of changed the game a little bit in that regard.
Boy, very good. Boy, good discussion. I like the Metrodome stuff and the Astrodome. Those are. How about Toronto? That was. I know you guys had a rough series in Toronto.
Yeah, seems like we always have a rough series in Toronto.
Well, because the AstroTurf kind of got you in that. Remember
the
balls of the speed of that AstroTurf got you up there.
There's no question, and that's why I brought it up. You know, when you're used to playing on grass, and now you go to the turf, it's a little bit easier because the ball takes a true hop. But the speed of the game is different. The ball comes off the bat different. There's different plays. The ball bounces different. And really where it can be more difficult on AstroTurf is in the daytime. The turf gets more spongy.
Really?
I know when we play in St. Louis in the heat of the day, the ball would bounce higher, so you'd get more choppers. How many times you see the ball hit to the outfield and the ball almost bounces over the outfielder's head? Those things happen more when the sun's out in the heat of the day. It would have more bounce to it opposed to at night. And I never liked, you know, the day game on AstroTurf because the ball bounced a little bit higher and it wasn't as easy to field the ball.
I never knew that. All right, it's Sunday morning with the professor. Very good. Very good stuff. All right, we'll take a break. A couple of things hit me in just watching some of the games on TV when you guys are on the road. The coaches always talk to the runner at first base or third base. And the first baseman, I saw it the other night, Adrian Gonzalez, was his ear. Who's that guy? Do we know him? Isn't that...
That's the third base coach, Phil Nevin.
Okay, good. I want to take a break. I want to ask you, what do you say to these people? Because the first base, the guy is standing right next to you. What can you possibly say? I mean, you know, and it looks like a serious conversation. So I want to talk to you about that. And also this bunt defense that the Cubs threw at you guys where the first baseman crashed in. I want to talk to you a little bit about what the hitter does. And Ty Block, boy, laid down quite a sacrifice bunt after getting one right under him. It was a Nolan Ryan, give that man a bow tie.
Yeah.
And block and then get the bunt down. I want to talk about that, too. So we'll take a break with Woe. We'll be back with him right after this. All right, nice having you back here. Woe, you want to grab that mic there? We're doing all right?
It sounds good.
Yeah, very good. Okay. Let's start with this one. Guys are on first base or third base, and Phil Nevin just walked by the third base coach. And very important information is transmitted to the runner. But the first baseman or third baseman, they're like within 6 inches of you. What goes on and what do you say?
Well, it's changed quite a bit over the years. And, you know, this is the information age. There's no doubt about it. And, you know, just to prepare for a series, we got a binder that looks, you know, like the size of the Bible to go through to get ready for the game. There's information on everything. And, you know, in today's game, the first base coaches, the base coaches have all the information they need. They'll have the release times, the guys move. And, you know, the players, you know, they're focused on their hitting and their defensive side, but they're not putting as much detail into what the coach's job is to know, you know, everything about the pitcher, his move, his release times, you know, is he prone to throwing the ball in the dirt? So most of the time they're reminding the runner of situations. They give him release times. And as you said, the fielders on the other team are right there. But you'll be surprised what's said and nothing happens. I mean, everybody kind of knows the information. But if you're sharp and if you're a guy that wants to get an edge, you certainly can use some of that and relay stuff back to the bench if you hear the coach talk about, you know, we want you to go here, or yeah. you know, this is his times. We, you know, a lot of coaches will say, hey, you're going. You know, the good coaches will have, you know, maybe they'll touch the guy, they'll come up. For instance, Joe LeFay would come up. A guy has a difficult time getting the sign. They'd always go up to the runner at first base, put your hand on him. As the coach goes through the sign, if it was a steal, he might tap him on the back, squeeze him a little bit, a hit and run, he might squeeze him twice. So, you know, they come up for a couple reasons. Make sure they get signs, but give them information and also go over the situation of the game. Now, we did all that back in the day on your own, right? You get to the base, you check the fielder, you look at the scoreboard, you know this, how many outs, you know, I don't want to make the third out at third base, I want to make the first out there. You went over all the scenarios, but today the coach's job is to help the player with all this and give him information that maybe he has not gone over yet.
You ever tell the first baseman, would you move back a little?
Well, you know, what started happening years ago, we like to get our third baseman, and teams did it to us. You know, when you're coaching third base and you have a man on third and it's a possible squeeze situation, you know, when you're putting on those signs at third base, everybody's looking at you. You got 40,000 people looking at you. You have the other coaches and managers looking at you to try to pick up something. And you can get very subconscious. Now we like to take the third baseman and have him go stand right at third base. So now when he gives the signs, typically the third base coach on a squeeze or a safety squeeze, the runner at third is not looking at the coach. He gives a sign to the hitter. Now the third base coach comes over to the runner and gives him a verbal or something with the hand to let him know. So if that third base coach is standing running the base, it makes their communication more difficult, makes him more self-conscious, and a lot of times you can deter the sign from even being put on.
Isn't that funny? Boy, that's the inside of the game. You know, it's funny.
And that stuff happens. It's been happening for years. That's, you know, that's what we try to do on the field.
So people get so upset, though, if a runner on second tips a pitch. Now, why is that any different than what we're talking about here?
Well,
runner on second tips a pitch, and my God, you know, the next thing you know, they're throwing at people and they're pointing and all that.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I think back in the day, it was policed by the players a lot easier. You know, I mean, if you knew a guy at second base was relaying signs, you did one of two things. One, the catcher would go out and change a sign. Two, he might set up on his location a lot later in the pitch, you know, if he sets up Burley. You know, in three, they just might drill the hitter for you know, trying to do this. Or four, they may set him up. The catcher may set up away, you know, real early and put curveball, and they'll throw a fastball in on the guy just to let them know that, hey, you know, you don't have the signs. And that's, those things will stop it right then and there. Today's game seems to be a little bit different. You know, guys like to yell and scream a lot more than they do to do something about it. And I feel it's our responsibility as a defensive team to do something so they cannot relay the signs, because guys are always going to try to do that.
Do you ever think that there's a telescope in the scoreboard or anything like that?
Oh, yeah. Over the years, shoot. I think one of the you know, first places for me was back in the late 90s was Arizona with Buck Showalter. You know, when they had those real good teams in 98, they had a very, very good team. First year in the ballpark. He had 2 years to prepare for his season, right? He was scouting and getting players. And we always felt that, you know, not necessarily a telescope, but there's a light. There's cameras up there. There's somebody up there relaying the pitches to the hitters. And it's not only there. There's many, many ballparks. And if you ask most pitching coaches in the game today, when guys are on base or guys are hitting a pitcher for some reason, you know, he throws a good breaking ball and that hitter's all over it, they're looking out in the stands. They're looking out in center field trying to see if somebody's relaying the sign. I'll tell you, we were in, I think it was in, might have been in Miami, or I'm not sure of the city, but we had a whistle going on 1 year. Every time there was a breaking ball, we heard a whistle from the stands. And we're trying to figure out, somebody in the stands was relaying the pitch to the hitters. It wasn't all the hitters, but there was a couple of hitters. And every time there was a breaking ball, we hear the whistle in the stands that somebody was relaying the pitch to the guy in the field.
So what do you do?
There's not much you can do. It's just be aware of it and try to and mix up your signs. But we were under the belief that somebody in the stands was relaying the pitches.
Well,
to
get
the,
your own whistle, and you whistle when it, when it's not a fastball.
Yeah, no kidding.
That would have
no
been
kidding.
The deal. Get Sean Dunstan and shop and get him get you a whistle.
Well, when these things happen, you know, kind of in the spur of the moment, and only for a few innings or one day, it's really hard to combat it. But as far as looking to the stands for the signs or watching the runners at second, you know, Rags is always watching the guy at second. Oh yeah, we all do. Or he'll tell me, hey, look at him. We think he's tipping, you know, because when a team's hitting well with runners in scoring position, and a lot of teams on the East Coast, it seems to me that not as much in our division, but out on the East Coast, most of those teams are always trying to relay signs from second base. It's well documented. You get players from different teams come in. You can use the video system today. There's a lot of ways to do it because there's TV cameras all over. You can get the signs catchers right off the TV, and now you can bring it right into the game somehow to let the guys know what's going on.
So. Wow, the technology. Right.
Yeah.
But you know, it's part of baseball forever.
Yes.
Forever. Look, the Giants are accused of doing it in 1951, that they had something in the scoreboard and a buzzer system. And Leo Durocher had this whole thing going on, and it's wild. Yeah.
It's part of the game, and I don't think there's, you know, I don't think it's happening in the stands in center field, but you know, on the field, the players are going to try to get it. The base coaches looking in to get the signs, to relay the signs. Catchers get lazy, you know, they don't give the signs correctly. You can pick up the signs, but you can get the signs from TV, and the base runners could take advantage of that when they get out to second base, knowing what pitch is coming. It's a lot easier to do with all the television cameras today.
Absolutely. Hey, did you ever get signs as a third base coach? Did you ever get in and see the sign and relay it?
Well, yeah, you try to do everything you can, especially.
You do it?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, that's why the base coaches in reality are supposed to stay in the coaching box. Or it's not so much that you want them in the box, but you don't want them close to the field. Because the closer you get to the field, when the catcher's giving the signs, the catcher can't block his signs. Yeah. So you have to watch the base coaches and make sure they're back off the field, and now the catcher can do his thing. But when you get close to third base, it's very easy to see the sign, and that's very easy to relay.
I'm going to have to watch that.
Yeah, well, it's not as exciting as watching the game, but it does go on.
All right, very good. Great inside baseball this morning. Very good. We'll wrap it up with this one, because I did want to talk about the Cub bunt defense. Let's do that one, because the third baseman crashes. I mean, and this is years ago. I remember seeing pictures of it with Ferris Fain and Keith Hernandez and Mattingly, all these great first basemen, and he crashes on a bunt situation where you want to get the bunt down to third. And he gets to the plate and even crosses the plate. I've seen that happen. But my question to you is, what is the hitter supposed to do when that happens? Because you're bunting to someone who's 7 feet away.
Yeah. Well, you know, every team has a crash play. Every team in the National League, anyway, has a crash play. That means it's a bunt play where, you know, the third baseman's coming down and the first baseman's coming down. If there's a crash play on, and usually a shortstop will dictate that, if the shortstop's breaking towards third, because okay. he has to cover third if the third baseman's crashing, or if he's set up way towards third, the hitter should know that these guys are going to crash, and there's nowhere to bunt the ball. That's when you swing or slash. What the Cubs do and other teams have done over the years, and we've been more aggressive at times. They're more aggressive with their first baseman. It's not a true crash play, but it's a crash play using the first baseman. The third baseman's holding his ground, right. So the shortstop. But the first baseman's right down your throat, right? Yeah. Rizzo starts halfway to home plate. He's so close he has to use a different glove. He has to use a fielder glove That's because right. he's not the first baseman. Well, he's coming in, and when the batter squares, if he's in that position, you need to go ahead and swing. And you know, some managers are very aggressive, and it's risky too. So if you have a good hitting pitcher, there's no doubt he's going to swing. But most teams use this play with a poor hitting pitcher. If you want to let him pull back and swing and not butt the ball, go ahead, because he's not a good hitter. That's the thought process. So they bring the first baseman way down, and as you said, he's not only covered on the first base side, he'll go across the mound, he'll go to the third base side if the bunter is attempting to bunt and does not swing.
Well, great. Because it depends on the hitter, as the pitcher too.
It depends on the hitter, and you know, everybody's different. Some guys are more aggressive. They don't want you know, in a situation, the game will dictate it. You don't want that runner to advance, but it's risky. When you're that aggressive, if the batter swings, there's a lot of holes on the field. And instead of bunting the guys over and having second and third play the infield in, and maybe your pitcher, you know, gets out of it, you got a chance for a big inning. Wow. When they run these crash plays, if that batter swings and gets a base hit, it changes the whole complexion of the inning to maybe not just one run, but multiple runs.
Wow,
in the
beautiful.
Inning.
Oh, that's good. I'm going to watch for that. Yeah. This is good. I'm going to now see when that, because I love it when they crash. I like it. I like when there's people running all over the place and see what's going to happen. But I didn't realize this, and you just said it, and it's true. Rizzo has to get a different glove if he's crashing like that. I didn't know that.
Yeah, the rule is the Pirates made a big stink of it last year when Rizzo sets up close to home plate, halfway to home plate. It's not his position. He can use the first baseman glove if the second baseman is still somewhat near second base. But the minute the second baseman comes and stands right at first base, now the second baseman in reality becomes the first baseman. Ah. He has to have the first baseman's glove. Rizzo now has to have an infield glove, which, you know, if I was the Pirates at the point, I'd rather have Rizzo have his first baseman's glove, because it's bigger, it's harder to get the ball out of to make a throw. So in reality, it helps Rizzo field the bunt and throw to a base if he has to use an infield glove. So that's what dictates it, the second baseman's positioning, where he starts.
That's another thing to watch. And what happens if he doesn't change glove? Who makes him change the glove?
Well, the umpires do now, because they're aware of it. Or if they're not aware of it, probably the opposing manager has to say something. But honestly, I don't see where the advantage is. I'd rather have Rizzo with the first baseman glove trying to field the bunt because it's bigger, and the second baseman with a small glove in case it's a good bunt, and he has to throw there with the smaller glove, you know, at first base to catch the throw, opposed to having it reversed.
Boy, what a Sunday morning. It's not just C-ball, hit-ball anymore, huh?
Well,
it sounds like you got a real job here. My goodness. Yeah, there's a lot to it.
Well, there's a lot of different situations that come up, and the whole key is execution, right?
Yeah.
No matter what you try to do or what play you're using or what the scenario is, you need to execute. Like Ty Block did on that bunt that we saw in Milwaukee. What a great, gutsy bunt he put down after that pitch. when it was right at his head, from what I understand.
Yeah, it was. It knocked him. I mean, it was past his head. And,
yeah.
You know, stood right in there, backed up just a little bit maybe on the next pitch. But, boy, he got the bunt down. It was beautiful.
Yeah, we've all been there. You know, you square around the bunt and the ball's right at your head. It's a little unnerving. And for a pitcher in that scenario, you know, it's one thing for a position player to do it, but not a square back around and put down the bunt.
Pretty good.
A lot of guts, and it tells you a lot about Ty Block and the player he is.
Boy, well, great. I loved it. Very good. We covered a lot of ground this morning, and congratulations on being the professor here. You got a good audience, let me tell you.
Well, I enjoyed it, Marty, and I look forward to seeing you next week.
All right, a couple of weeks. All right, more with Ron Wotus in a couple of weeks. Now back KNBR 680, and we'll finish up here and head out to the Public House right after this. More coming up.